So this morning's reading is from the book of Luke, chapter 6, verses 17 to 36. It's on page 1034 of these Bibles. Jesus went down with his disciples and stood on the level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem and from the coast of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by evil spirits were cured, and the people all tried to touch him, because power was coming from him and healing them all. Looking at his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven, for that is how their fathers treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that is how their father treated the false prophets. But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who ill-treat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful." And this morning we're going to be looking mainly at the second half of that, but I've read the whole of it just to give you the wider picture. So let me ask you a question. Have you ever wondered why it's so hard to give something a name? Now, this is something that's on our family's mind at the minute. I'm expecting to get a phone call any day soon from my brother saying that I've got a new baby nephew. He's already at least a week late, but for our family, that's not bad going. So what are the questions you ask when a new baby is born? Well, you always ask, how was the labor? You ask, how much did the baby weigh? But perhaps the most important question, what are you going to call him or her? And I think for many parents, it can be a long and anguished process. How exactly can you sum up this entire new life in just a few letters? I found the lists my parents wrote after my youngest brother was born, and there were sort of sheaves and sheaves of names. So I think they looked at about 200 different names before deciding on the one they did. And it's not just people. Inventions and ideas can stand or fall on what you call them. So much so, there are entire businesses out there on the web whose sole purpose is to decide what is the best name for your product. So who has heard of the game Criss Crosswords, for instance? Well, it's not a very imaginative name, and it didn't sell very many, but then it was rebranded a few years later under the name Scrabble. And now we've all heard of it, and probably most of us have played it. Or an iPod. Now, an iPod is, I hope there's no Apple aficionados here, an iPod is really just another portable music player. But Apple have given it this fancy name, and by doing that, they've set it off as something different, something new, something exciting. So what happens if you've got something genuinely different and you want a name for it? And that's a problem that Jesus and the early Christians were facing when they were trying to write down his teaching. Probably you'd have been seeing over recent weeks, you've been looking at the radical lifestyle that Jesus calls us to in many different respects. Jesus lived a very radical life. And we're called to imitate that. Everything Jesus did was not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of others, or to set an example for the future. And the way that Jesus died his death is also for the benefit of others. Jesus died solely so that people of that time, and people of all time, including us, can be reconciled to God and get to know God. So what do you call this concept? Now, the New Testament was written in Greek. There wasn't a word for it in the Greek language. And that's what the New Testament was written in. So we think of it as love, as it's usually translated. And there's plenty of words for love in Greek. There's sort of family love, there's sexual love, there's doing something nice for somebody to do something back. But the writers didn't want any of those concepts because they were wrong. The point wasn't that you did it out of any loyalty, out of sexual attraction, or out of a desire for a return. So they actually invented a new word. Or rather, they found something, a very obscure word in Old Greek. And somewhat appropriately, this word is now probably the most famous word in New Testament Greek. If you only know one word of Greek, you know this one, and that word is agape. So that's all the Greek I'm going to tell you this morning, but that's where that word comes from. And the importance for this passage is that in Luke's Gospel, the first time that word appears is right here in verse 27. It says, I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, or agape your enemies, as Luke would have written originally. And agape would have been something that Luke's readers knew about. It was written to people who were already Christians or knew something about it. They knew about this concept. They wanted to know something about it. And Luke is keeping them hanging on for six entire chapters before telling you what it is. So what we can look at, particularly verses 27 to 31, as a definition of agape, this whole new radical lifestyle. What does Jesus want us to do? So let's start with an obvious interpretation, that we're meant to take these verses precisely literally. There's a problem here. I think it's fair to say no Christian here would say, give to everyone who asked them and take it literally. So for instance, you might head home after the service, you're going to your front door, a neighbour comes up and he says, Steve, give me £1,000, I want to build a new swimming pool in my garden. Now, I don't know whether Steve has £1,000, but I suspect he wouldn't give £1,000 towards that. But it does say, give to everyone who asks them. And I think, even after listening to this sermon, you would think that anybody who said yes to that was a bit of a sucker. But that doesn't even apply to all good causes. I don't think anybody here responds to every single charity letter that comes through the door, or they see on TV, even if you agree with the causes. Even though probably we can give more money than we do. Are we going soft? Well, we'll come back to that. If we look at the New Testament, that's slightly heartening because we find that they don't do it either. You can read Acts and all the letters to the churches, and there's very little, if anything, about giving money away to people outside the church. Plenty about giving money to people inside the church, but not to outside the church. And I think you can bet that if this genuinely was Christian practice as intended, then the people in the Roman Empire would exploit the early church. They'd go up to the Christians and say, your holy book says, give us your money. And the Christians would give the money away, and they'd be impoverished and starved to death. Well, that didn't happen. Or indeed, turn the other cheek. What do we do with this? Now, in this case, we look at the Bible and see a very mixed picture. You remember the story of the Apostle Stephen, and I think he's the best example in the Bible of turning the other cheek. He gives this amazing sermon about who Jesus is. And the response? People want to stone him to death. And what does Stephen do? He goes to his death meekly. He prays for his persecutors, doing exactly what it says in here. And amongst the people he prays for is the person who became the Apostle Paul. So what does Paul do in the similar cases? Well, Paul was also threatened with being murdered on multiple occasions. But in Acts, he doesn't get murdered, he doesn't get stoned to death. He either gets out of the way, or his friends smuggle him out, in one case in a basket. So even Jesus doesn't keep to these rules. We have an account in John at his trial where Jesus was slapped on the cheek. What does he do? Does he turn the other cheek? No, he questions why he's being slapped and challenges the accusations against him. So I don't think we can take these verses literally. So what do we do with them? And I think probably the most helpful suggestion is that they're ideals. They are ideal behaviours we should aspire to, but because of the practicalities of the world we live in, we can't actually reach them. They show us the spirit of behaviour we should aim for. And I think this is probably a good thing, because we don't want Jesus to give us a rule book. It would be rather odd if Jesus said, you must give 80% of your money away. That seems, it's a bit odd. And it's also going back into the same kind of Jewish ideas that he was arguing against. Jesus gives a principle that giving money away with wisdom is a good principle. Here he's expressing it in quite an extreme way. But that's to make the point, so that every time we have money, we should think, Jesus says this, how do we apply this? And we can put this in the same category as other teaching Jesus gives about how we think. Jesus is on record as saying, call on your brother a fool is as bad as murdering them, or looking at a woman lustfully is as bad as committing adultery. And I don't think we necessarily agree with those things. Jesus is saying that to say, not this equals this, but that what we think matters, and our thoughts have implications for what we do. And I think that is what's being said here as well. Jesus is really interested in how we think and how we react to these things. He's interested in what we do as well, but what we do starts with where we think. So what's agape? I think agape is fundamentally, it's a state of mind. It's a willingness to sacrifice ourselves for others. Even if we don't actually come to that sacrifice, we can't give away absolutely everything, but we should be willing to if we're called to. And I think there has to be an element of wisdom involved, as Jesus teaches elsewhere. So with that in mind, what exactly is Jesus telling us to think about in these particular verses? Now, there's plenty going on in these 10 verses of Luke, but I'm going to look at it under the heading I was given of sacrifice to conventional life, and look at two aspects of life that we have in this world and see what Jesus is telling us to do, which is different. And I'm going to look at it in terms of power and in terms of resources. So, what does our conventional life say about power? Well, we've just had an election. That says something about power. The way to get anywhere in the world is to amass power, either by being elected or by some other means, get people to follow you, get authority, and then use that authority as you see fit. And that's going to be in some combination. We use the power partly for our own benefit and partly, hopefully, for the benefit of others. It's the concept known as enlightened self-interest, as the philosophers call it. It's a combination of doing what we want and using our conscience to do good for others. What would Jesus say to this? He'd say, no, that's not the point. This kind of power is irrelevant. It might be appropriate for individual Christians to seek power, if they have a calling to do that. So I think it's a good thing we have Christian MPs. But what Jesus is saying is that the true transformative power comes from a different source altogether. It comes through serving others. It comes through loving people. And it comes through praying for people. It comes through bringing God's power down into the world rather than using our own power. And Jesus is saying here, it's important to serve people and love people, even if they hold different views, even if they're oppressing us. they are still worthy of God's love. Even if we're misunderstood, we need to understand others. And I think there's also an element of undermining power here. The verse about the cloak and the tunic. In Jesus' day, basically you only had two layers of clothing. You had an outer garment, which is a cloak, and you had a tunic, which is your underwear. So what Jesus is saying is, if someone takes your outer clothing, then you're going to get cold, but you're at least decent. But if you tell people, take my tunic as well, you're inviting them to strip you naked. And that was a big taboo in those days, as it was here. You're making them look ridiculous. And I think some of the biggest wins Christians have had in getting anything done in recent years is partly through making people look ridiculous or embarrassing them. A particular one I want to think about is the fair trade movement. How has fair trade worked? Well, it certainly hasn't happened by having a fair trade party in Parliament. I don't think any MPs have stood on the particular fair trade issue, Christian or otherwise. What happened with fair trade is that numerous Christians, and indeed others, have made lots and lots of small sacrifices. They've said, we're going to spend slightly more money for our coffee, for our bananas, for whatever, because we think this is right. And that's what that's effectively done is embarrassed all the big companies into doing something about it. They're thinking, well, maybe there's something in this after all. Maybe we're being shown up as unfair, as unjust. And that's the kind of Christian power that Jesus is talking about. So what's the consequence of this for our practical lives? Well, one thing definitely is that we should be vulnerable. It takes a lot of guts to go up to somebody and say, strip me naked, take this as well. It's very easy. It would be very easy just to run away, to be in our Christian bubble, not to have to face enemies at all. But to be vulnerable, you actually have to go out there into the world and do something. And we know that there's a world out there that needs us. We can't just sit in this church and do our thing. There's a village out there with thousands of people who don't know Christ. There's people in our work lives who don't know Christ. And we have to interact with them. We have to open ourselves up to them. We have to say, we are Christians. And yes, you might not like that, but this is who I am. This is what we believe. And just to pick up an example about persecution. Do we actually have these enemies today? Well, maybe we do, maybe we don't. I think one example I've been thinking about is how schools relate. Now, the school I went to, 20-odd years ago, there were Christians in the school. I wasn't one of them at this point. There was a Christian union. They did their thing on a Friday lunchtime. And you vaguely knew that some of your friends might be Christians. But they never talked about it. They didn't get any stick for it either. So at least at school, you could live a Christian life without opposition. Because people never ever talked about it. Today, I think things have shifted quite differently. At least the youth I know about. There are much more active Christian unions. They actually go out and talk about Christ to their friends. And for some of them, this is a real struggle. They get bullied, they get teased, they get very difficult questions asked of them. But they're actually getting the word out there. And I think in terms of what's actually being done, the youth of today are do much better than the youth of my era. The friends I knew at school who were Christians then, I think have all fallen away. The youth I see today, who I know who are currently at school, I can see some of them becoming very strong Christians. They've been tested by what's happening. God has blessed them for taking this risk, for going out there. But perhaps more importantly, they're getting the word out there to the school so that the kids at school who don't go to church actually see that there's something about Christ there, some questions that need to be asked. And I don't know what the statistics are, But I think that through what they're doing, people are becoming Christians. So what does this mean for our sacrifice? When it comes to power, worldly power says, get power, use power. What Jesus is saying, sacrifice that right. You don't have the right for worldly power. You don't have the right for worldly authority. But there are other benefits from doing things my way. And the second point, on resources. Jesus says, we should do good to all. Well, there's a limit to what we can do. We don't have enough money between us to solve all of the world's problems. We don't have the time. So there is a wisdom element here. We have to be wise in how we use these things. But we do need to use our resources for the benefit of others. And this can apply in different ways. So we can talk about financial resources, which is the sort of obvious thing the passage is talking about. We need to be willing to give to those who need money, and without expecting repayment. So on a national scale, we need to be willing for our money to go to the developing world, where there's greater need than there is here. We need to also argue for justice so that these things don't keep happening. We're certainly not called to totally impoverish ourselves. There are some Christians who are. They're called to give away absolutely everything and live on the good grace of other Christians or other people. That's a specific calling, but that's not what we're all called for. But what Jesus is calling us to do is to think very hard before we spend money unnecessarily on ourselves. Or another resource that we have is time. And something that we can do as Christians is spend time with people who need it. And I think in the world we have, that's something which is very important. There's been reports this week about how loneliness has increased beyond all recognition. There's some scary statistics from Childline that something like 40% of the people phoning them are worried about loneliness. There are people out there who just don't seem to fit into society and who Christians have a role to look after. And some of these people are really, really difficult people to be with. I'm sure we know this. There are people out there who, for whatever reason, have had a really difficult life or just aren't quite able to relate in the way we might like. And giving time to them takes a long time, and it's quite emotionally very difficult. But these people need the love of Christ. Another newspaper quote. This is from yesterday's Guardian, which is a throwaway comment in the middle of an article about a lady who has an autistic child. And she wrote, church youth clubs and scout teams are often run by wonderful, forgiving people with a moral compass and a feel for difficult kids. I think that's a real testament to whoever worked with her son that she could write that. And I don't know what people here have done. I've worked with kids who are on the autistic spectrum. And it's incredible. It is very difficult. You're giving a lot all the time. You don't seem to get very much back. But ultimately, you are feeding into their lives. You're giving them something they need. And they see the love of Christ through it. But although the thanks are welcome, and I think it's really good when somebody you have been spending time with or money says thank you, that isn't really the point. It's not the point for individuals or the church. We do it out of this agape principle because they need it and we have it and we love them. We shouldn't expect the reward in this world, although we sometimes do get it. So what does this say about sacrifice? Well, I think the conventional wisdom is for our resources, we should invest them to get the best possible return, whether that's financial or in time. Jesus is saying we should sacrifice this right of return on our investment. But he is saying that we will get a reward. It's just the reward isn't in this world necessarily, it's in the next world. And this reward is to be sons of the Most High. And I'm not going to go into details of what that means. That's another whole sermon, really. But it's saying that we get this closer relationship with God. By serving God and getting to know him, then we relate to God better, and God feeds into our lives so that we can get and serve, and it all builds up. And we also get something in the next world, And what reward means in heaven, I don't know. It's something good. We can trust God for that. How it works out in practice, we'll find out. But it's there. So this might seem like a trade-off. But it's not a very difficult trade-off if you think about it. What we gain is far, far better than what we give up. Because that relationship with God and that eternity in heaven is far better than anything we have from this world. So what is Luke at root saying about agape? What's this way of Christ that we're called to follow? Well, we've said that these aren't literal rules, but they're principles that we should consider in every single aspect of our lives. Because pretty much everything we do in some way impacts on the power we have to change things, on resources that we can give out. We shouldn't automatically, without thinking, sacrifice things for others. We should do so with wisdom, through prayer and through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And we should do this because these things that God's given us, they aren't for us. They're for the entire world and for others. So we shouldn't be living the conventional life. We shouldn't be trying to seek power, to seek resources, to seek wealth. We should be willing to give that up. But by giving that up, we get an eternal life, which is far better.